From the nation's capital for National Public Radio, this is David Maupas, speaking to you from the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In just a few moments, the seventh of the current series of national town meetings. These programs, as was the purpose of last year's spring and fall series, are aimed at presenting public figures from various fields discussing the major issues of the day. The topic of this national town meeting, how can the right of privacy be better protected? The principal speakers will be Democratic Congresswoman Bella Abzug of New York, Republican Congressman Barry Goldwater Jr. of California, and Dr. Louis Branscombe, Chief Scientist and Vice President of IBM. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. And now the moderator of this national town meeting, Josh Darsa.
The national town meeting will be in session. Welcome to another in this series of town meetings. Like their historic predecessors, these gatherings are an attempt to discuss and debate the key issues of the day and to bring together some of the principal figures concerned with such issues with you. Our audience gathered here in the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Center, and our audience listening in all over America via member stations of National Public Radio. The issue before us, how can the right of privacy be better protected? An issue focused by proposed legislation and inquiries being brought up by various members of the Congress, an issue illuminated by various undertakings of recent administrations and their agencies. More undoubtedly will be heard on what was done and what should be done in the next hour or so from our distinguished speakers and from members of the audience who choose to present questions to them. Bella S. Abzug, Congresswoman from New York City, representing the 20th Congressional District, has been active in political and social movements for change most of her life. She studied at the Jewish Theological Seminary, Hunter College, and Columbia University, from which she received her law degree and where she was an editor of the Columbia Law Review. Upon receiving her LLB, she became involved in labor law, tenants cases, and early civil rights cases. In the 1960s, she helped organize the Women's Strike for Peace and led mass lobbies to Washington for the nuclear test ban treaty, disarmament, and an immediate end to the war in Vietnam. She also was prominent in Reform Democratic Party politics, was active in the 1968 Eugene McCarthy campaign, and was co-chairwoman of Women for McGovern in 1972. Her service as a member of Congress began in 1971, and as a member of the House Government Operations Committee, as she worked on the Freedom of Information Act, and is an opponent of government secrecy and government data banks that compile personal information on private citizens. Recently, while chairing her subcommittee on government information and individual rights, she vividly illustrated some personal experiences related to such matters. Dr. Louis Branscombe, Vice President and Chief Scientist of IBM. Dr. Branscombe is the man responsible for guiding his corporation's scientific and technical programs to ensure that they meet long-term needs. He is quite concerned about the relationship between our growing computer technology and individual rights. Before joining IBM in 1972, Dr. Branscombe was director of the National Bureau of Standards, which he first joined in 1951. Dr. Branscombe was graduated from Duke University with highest honors, received his MS and PhD degrees from Harvard. Dr. Branscombe has received numerous scientific and public service awards and has served as a member of the President's Science Advisory Commission, member of the National Academy of Engineering, member of the Council of the National Academy of Sciences. He currently is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and the American Physical Society. Barry M. Goldwater, Jr., representative from the 20th District of California. First elected to the House in 1969, He has been in the forefront of activity aimed at the protection of individual rights and personal privacy. Many consider him one of the legislative spearheads of the Right to Privacy Act of 1974, which became law at the beginning of this year. Born in Los Angeles, he graduated from Arizona State University. He is a member of the House Committee on Science and Technology, serves on the Subcommittee on Aviation and Transportation, Research and Development, is the ranking Republican on the Subcommittee on Energy Research, Development and Demonstration, but his interests on Capitol Hill range far beyond technological matters. He has taken strong interest in the problems of handicapped people and has led efforts in the Congress to improve the quality of education for thousands of deaf youth in America. Few issues of the day more directly or immediately involve our citizenry than the one under discussion today. For her initial remarks on the subject, how can the right to privacy be better protected, here is Congresswoman Bella Abzug of New York.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here this morning to talk about a subject that might not have occurred to our forefathers when they wrote the Bill of Rights. Or neither to our foremothers, but in any case. The founders provided for many things, and I think they thought that they had taken care of all eventualities when they wrote the Bill of Rights, and we still bless them for that, especially with the hindsight of this post-Watergate period. But a great many things that are happening in this country and in the world would have astounded the founding fathers right out of their britches. In fact, if they had been able to envisage some of the problems that we're having in 1975 with the questions of privacy, they might well have decided to call off the revolution and headed for the hills. In any case, here we are at a very important discussion talking about a very complicated civilization, way beyond also the wildest imagining of Benjamin Franklin, our first postmaster general, or Thomas Jefferson, who was probably our first and almost last White House intellectual. Well, in the early days, as you know, letters were delivered by post horse, mail, newspapers, and books. They arrived from abroad every 7 weeks or so by ship, and the local tavern was the source of most information, accurate and otherwise. Maybe that hasn't changed too much today. In any case, we're dealing with a very serious subject today. We've got a lot of government collection of information. We have a lot of private collection of information. And our problem is, how can we protect the rights of individuals for information that has to be collected? Now, my subcommittee has jurisdiction in the House of Representatives over all aspects of the information policies and practices of every agency of the federal government. Part of our job is an oversight function to see that the Freedom of Information Act and the Privacy Act, which was passed last year, are faithfully administered. Basically, my subcommittee deals with two major questions of importance to you and all Americans. How can you find out what the government is doing and what it knows? That we do under the Freedom of Information Act. You have a right to ask questions of the government and get information that it has, your right to know. And how can you keep the government from finding out what you as an individual are doing when it's none of the government's business? That's your right of privacy. Now, these are the problems that my committee confronts. And since we're talking about how we can improve the privacy rights of individuals, I thought I would just run down in my opening remarks what the Privacy Act, in effect, provides. It requires an agency to tell an individual if he or she asks whether it has any records or files on him or her. It would give the individual access to records containing personal information about himself or herself and allow him or her an opportunity to try to correct any false data. If the agency refuses to make a correction sought, the individual could go to court in an attempt to force the agency to do so. If an agency wants to pass the information around, particularly outside that agency, and a lot of agencies do that, you know, they get a lot of information in case they can't use it, They make sure that somebody else uses it. Now, this violates the law, we think. And so if an agency wants to pass the information around, particularly outside the agency, it would, in many cases under our new law, have to get the individual's permission in writing. In demanding data from an individual, an agency would have to tell that individual whether there was any choice about answering and any penalties that might follow if that individual refused to answer. Illegal disclosures by an agency employee could lead to fines up to $5,000, and demands by anyone under false pretenses to see personal records could lead to similar fines. An individual in some situations could refuse to tell an agency of the federal, state, or local government what his Social Security or her Social Security number is. Now we have to make some corrections in this act. Last year, we provided exemptions. The act generally does not apply to law enforcement investigation files, classified files, questions affecting national security or foreign policy. On the other hand, we gave some rather special exemptions to organizations or agencies like the CIA, who swore up and down in many different forms that they did not collect any files illegally. You now know that they do, and so we also know that they do. So we have to now correct that and see that they don't have a special exemption. There is also the need, therefore, to tighten the act as we go through it with some amendments. There's also the need to make certain that we have an effective privacy commission, which this act provides for. Now, certain members have been appointed by the Congress, including Mr. Goldwater, to serve on that commission. However, as yet, the White House has not made its appointments, and therefore the commission is not functioning, so that a commission which is set up in order to further implement the operation of this act is not yet set up. But since the act itself is not going into effect until the fall of this year, it is hoped that this will take place very shortly. We are, of course, conducting many investigations today in the Congress of the United States concerning the functioning of agencies of government, particularly those that appear to have been interfering with the rights of individuals. The massive capabilities of government bureaucracy in the collection, management, selection, dissemination, and concealment of vast amounts of information of every conceivable type really concern the rights of every individual. I think our country is strong if we provide for a government that has information, but provide for a government that is not permitted to interfere with the rights of individuals, their rights of privacy, their individual First Amendment rights to espouse their own views, and to make certain that we have that kind of balance. We are conducting the many investigations in the House, which we'll talk about more, I'm sure, in the course of our back and forth discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Congresswoman Abzug. And now for his initial presentation, Dr. Louis Branscom.
The late Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis called privacy the value most prized by civilized man. Writing in the Harvard Law Review of 1890, he warned of mechanical devices that would threaten the solitude and privacy of the individual. Because of a cluster of new inventions, he noted, a next step was needed to protect a person's right to be let alone. That warning went largely unheeded, and the mechanical devices he wrote about so apprehensively, the snapshot camera and the telephone, quickly passed into familiar use, along with, as we now realize, infrared film, the telephoto lens, the telephone tap, and a variety of sophisticated listening devices. New technologies, however, did not create the privacy issue, nor did the computer create the data bank issue. The potential for violation of the individual's right to privacy dates the act at least to the first handwritten records and exists today in the ordinary filing cabinet. Technology can restrict access as a privacy safeguard, but can also permit selective access for freedom of information. In fact, technology can improve privacy safeguards. Dr. Alan F. Weston, who's professor of public law and government at Columbia and sort of a noted authority in privacy, concluded in his massive study that personal data can be better protected in computerized files than in manual ones, and in fact, most of the areas where he found abuses, the sensitive information was in manual files, even though they were computer files for other information. Computers are tools. which permits society to carry out policies for protecting privacy and the individual's legitimate need to know if we'll organize ourselves to do that job right. The IBM company has endorsed in their basic thrust four principles of privacy. First, an individual should be given access to information about him contained in record-keeping systems and a way to find out how the information is used. Second, there should be a way for an individual to correct or amend a record of identifiable information about that person. Third, an individual should be able to prevent information from being improperly disclosed or used for other than authorized purposes without his or her consent, unless required by law. Fourth, the custodian of data files containing sensitive information has a responsibility for endeavoring to maintain the reliability of the data and to take precautions to prevent misuse. These principles should apply, if they are to provide the desired protection, to the individual, to manual as well as computerized files. And the Privacy Act of 1974 applies these principles to the area of federal government files, both manual and otherwise. However, without waiting for legislation, many companies, employment agencies, and others are taking steps to better protect privacy. Indeed, the responsibility for privacy protection, like most other social values, starts at home. IBM is implementing a comprehensive program to protect the privacy of its more than 250,000 employees, and we are discontinuing the use of the Social Security number from all employee records except where its use is specifically required by law. Once society has decided how the principles I have described will be implemented, custodians of data collections must ensure that no one gains unauthorized access to the information or misuses it. This is the job of data security. While setting privacy rules is fundamentally a responsibility of society, the manufacturers of computers have responsibility for giving their customers better means of safeguarding sensitive data and restricting access to it. Just as one example, computers today are designed so that users may need both an identification card and a special password or code word in order to sign on the computer. And the systems are designed so that that user then may only access that part of the system to which he has a need to know. IBM has also developed a powerful mathematical method of encrypting information, which we have made available to the federal government through the National Bureau of Standards on a royalty-free basis in the United States. If necessary, encryption can completely frustrate any effort to steal data by wiretapping or copying files. In conclusion, I would like to point out that the private sector of our society has such complex and varied record-keeping systems that it appears that no simple rule could properly regulate safeguarding of privacy in them all. The Privacy Act of 1974 created a Privacy Study Commission, to which Ms. Abzug just referred, to investigate how privacy can better be safeguarded in the private sector and to make its recommendations known to Congress in 1977. The Commission has an extremely difficult task to do in a very short time, and it should be fully staffed and get underway. We should give it all the help we can.
Thank you, Dr. Branscum. And now for his initial presentation, Congressman Barry Goldwater, Jr.
Thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is an extreme honor to appear at Town Hall with my colleague, Bella Abzug, and Dr. Branscum. What is this business we're talking about today, the concept of privacy? Privacy is something that we kind of take for granted and have not really challenged as we open our wallet up and give our Social Security number. Privacy is an extension of your personality. So consequently, you should be guaranteed the protected right of personality. Your privacy is invaded when you are required or asked to disclose some sensitive personal information about yourself. In answering a government questionnaire, or to receive some direct benefit, credit in a store. Privacy, in essence, is the right to be left alone. The concepts of privacy are as old as our Constitution. Most Americans accept it as the bedrock of our freedom and have given it little thought until that is, an individual notices how insidiously his privacy is being invaded. Our Constitution does not mention privacy. And our courts and our laws have not really directed their attention toward privacy. And it has not been until the advent of technology used by bureaucrats to make order out of our society has, in fact, privacy become an issue. There was no pressing need some 20 years ago for any of this type of action. It is only because of the advent of modern electronics, computer and communication systems that serious problems with personal information arose. Before that time, personal information was difficult to record because it was done manually. It rarely left the physical vicinity of the record-keeping place or the person that was that collected the information. Obviously, there's no need to tell you or describe to you the problems that exist today because of modern technology. Now, I'm really talking about tyranny. This is no alarmist flight of fancy. We're fast becoming slaves to what I call technocracy. As a result of this, the Congress, in the last session, passed a public law, the Privacy Act of 1974, signed by President Ford. It was a nonpartisan effort. And in the forefront was my colleague, Bell Abzug. It's an initial thrust, and will need refinement. But it's the first time that the Congress has ever addressed itself to the concerns of the American people and their right to be left alone. My colleague Bellas described the basic thrust of the bill. In essence, it allows you to control information about you of a personal nature. It also created this study commission to report back in 2 years. It did something else, though, that I think is important, and it outlawed the use of the Social Security number from this point forward without the direct consent of the Congress. The use of the Social Security number is easy to understand. It's a beautiful number. But it is used for everything. And with modern technology and the computers that can talk to one another, the potential for linkage of information from one system to another becomes great. And it is this linkage that we're concerned about. It is the dehumanizing factor of the Social Security number that prompted an amendment to prohibit or at least control this use of the Social Security number. It's used for everything in Virginia. Supposedly, you're not supposed to be able to vote until you give your Social Security number. Now, that obviously is a direct violation of the 16th Amendment, which says that you have the right to vote without any preconditions. This bill is law, and it is in effect. It only deals with the federal government. There is a problem with the private sector, with businesses, industry. Consequently, to deal with that, I've introduced a bill with a title, H.R. 1984. Even the Congress is prone to dramatics, and 1984 is appropriate. It is basically the same bill that was passed by the Congress. And will, in my estimation, will provide a vehicle from which we can discuss the problems of the private sector. I hope that this bill never becomes law. I hope the private sector gets the spirit of the concerns of the American people and their invasion of their privacy and their rights, and initiates and institutes the appropriate kind of actions and safeguards within their own businesses to assure those rights. In closing, the road leading to 1984 is scarred with pitfalls. We must defang Big Brother. Let us insert privacy rights into the programs of the programmers. Let us restore human dignity as the cardinal principle rather than worship the gods of efficiency and economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman Goldwater. While the audience is getting ready with its questions, let's open generally by asking each of the panelists to elaborate on any failings any of you may see in the Privacy Act of 1974 and how these failings, in your opinion, may affect seriously an individual's right to privacy. Congresswoman Otzen.
Well, as I indicated earlier in my opening remarks, under the Privacy Act of 1974, all agencies of government, including the CIA and the Secret Service, have an exemption that protects them from disclosing any material related to national defense, foreign policy, or criminal investigations, and that's a valid exemption. However, in the instance of both the CIA and the Secret Service, who, as I related earlier, were not satisfied with that kind of exemption, they had written into the law a much broader exemption denying almost access to all of their files. Now, I opposed those exemptions, both in my committee and on the floor of the House unsuccessfully. The reason that I opposed it was that I felt that it was sort of a known secret that many of these agencies, particularly the CIA and the Secret Service, had indeed been acting beyond their authority as given to them by a law, both by the Congress and by executive action, and that they were indeed going into an area of domestic spying and super snooping, and that they shouldn't be permitted to do that. And if they were therefore collecting information in an unauthorized way, which invaded First Amendment rights, the right of association, the right to petition for a redress of grievances, the right to have a differing point of view, the right of privacy, that we should make it clear to them that they should stick to their business as authorized. In other words, we need a CIA to look into the question of information, which is intelligence gathering that we might need in order to evaluate and assess policies of our own government. But we don't need a CIA to become the chief super special government determining what individuals should be on lists if they happen to disagree with the given policy of the government at that time. Subsequently, it came out that indeed the CIA was collecting information about individuals who had a differing opinion about the war in Vietnam from that of the government. And they conducted extensive investigation, maintained extensive files, which dealt merely with people's opposition to the war. They came to the conclusion that this was not injurious to the government, that it did not have any foreign connections, but nevertheless, they have these enormous number of files. And I asked Mr. Colby whether he should notify all the individuals about whom he had these illegal files and return them to him. And while he was at it, since he mentioned the fact that there were a number of members of Congress that had he had some files on, I said, I'd like to see my own file while you're at it. Since I have, as you may know, some of you, or at least as introduced by the moderator today, been very actively opposed to the war in Vietnam for a long time, both before and during the time I was in the Congress of the United States. So I did get into that, and I have introduced an amendment which would eliminate the special exemption of the CIA. They would still be protected from revealing information which would affect questions of security and information that is desperately needed in terms of, intelligence gathering, but they would not be permitted to roam wildly all over the place as I think they have. I agree with my colleague here, Mr. Goldwater, that we've come a long way from 1776 to 1976, and eventually we'll come to 1984. But before we get there, I would hope that through our combined efforts, it won't be the Orwellian 1984 with its menacing big brother. And so it's very important that we try to restrain and to carefully guard the act and make sure that it's strong enough to protect the rights of individuals.
Dr. Branscombe.
Obviously, the most controversial issue about the Privacy Act of 1974 is the question of coverage, which Congresswoman Abzug has just discussed. I don't have any other important quarrels with the act. The important problem is to get the act implemented and get some experience with it. I think that experience is going to determine whether or not there are problems. And that experiment itself is terribly important in understanding what the implications may be for applying these principles to the private sector, because our government agencies should be able to determine quite clearly and in public view what the costs and difficulties are associated with implementing these very desirable principles.
Congressman Goldwater.
Just in follow-up, it might be interesting to point out that also in the last Congress, which I would like to classify as a privacy Congress, there was passed an amendment to the Education Act, which allowed school children and parents to see their children's records. And I think that is a significant step forward. There are many areas we need to look into. One, for instance, is the relationship between a patient and his doctor, and the increasing encroachment by government into that sacred relationship. We have such things as PSROs and other types of activities where the federal government is monitoring, in essence intervening, in between that patient and doctor relationship that needs to be examined. The whole banking institution is being invaded by government today. I once felt that my bank account, which was not very heavy, but was between me and my banker. But in fact, you've got a third partner there, the federal government. Banks are required to photograph every check that's written, and the federal government can come in under certain circumstances, and in fact, law enforcement agencies can come in and look at your bank account. Obviously, criminal justice, we have to do something about that, and in fact, the Congress is looking at that in the Judiciary Committee. The whole business of census and the intrusion into your homes and into your lives, all in the name of counting the American people, has gotten out of hand. There's no need for the federal government to know how many toilets you have or how many people sleep in your house or what kind of food you eat. This whole business of taking the census needs to be reviewed and analyzed from the standpoint of protecting your privacy. And one last thing I think needs to be done to further enhance the rights of privacy is to get the states of our United States to enact compatible state legislation that will deal with privacy from the state standpoint. I know that in the state of Ohio, there is a state legislator I've been working with, and he has been very careful to make sure that in drafting the Ohio State Privacy Act, that it is compatible with the federal act. So these are some of the areas that are missing, and I'm sure that with the perseverance and tenacity of my colleague, Bella Abzug, we're going to get into those and solve those problems.
Thank you, Congressman. I see quite a few people now standing on the microphones on either side of the theater, and we have quite a few questions here that have been written. So I hope to get all of the questions in. So let me emphasize once again, ladies and gentlemen, that if your questions and your answers could be as succinct as possible, I'm sure everybody would be appreciative. Now let's go to the lady at the microphone.
My name is Thoral Kaplan, and I'm the Public Affairs Director of the National Federation of Business and Professional Women's Clubs. And I'd like to ask the panel, what can a group such as ours, either as a group or private individuals, do to protect the right of privacy?
who is your question addressed to?
Let's start with Congressman Goldwater.
The suggestion I would be to become activists in this and, in essence, challenge the private sector, challenge some of these businesses around your area and ask them what they're doing from an administrative standpoint as well as a policy standpoint to implement these principles of privacy. And that's what we're trying to do. I think the federal government's moving in the right direction with this public law. 2 years from now, the Privacy Commission will make recommendations to the Congress as it pertains to the private sector. But there's no reason why we can't start right now. And IBM has been in the forefront of this as far as the private sector is concerned. I think they have a long ways to go, but at least they have the spirit. And we want these businesses, either small to large, to get the same kind of spirit so we don't have to pass laws. We've got too many laws in this country as it is now. So if we can do this voluntarily, I think we're better off.
Would the representative from IBM care to respond?
I just make the point that I believe a very important part of the whole issue is good personnel practices in large organizations, whether they be private businesses, universities, local or federal government, or whatever. And an organization like yours might very usefully examine the varied personnel practices in different types of organizations to determine how they handle questions like, do you ask an employee in an employment interview if they have a police record or not? And IBM, we do not. How long does the manager keep the past performance evaluations of an employee? Or do they throw them away after 3 years and give people a chance to forget a bad prior slate long overcome? Is information inside an employing organization restricted to those elements of management that need it? For example, if you reimburse an employee for medical expenses, does his immediate boss have to see that? Or is it sufficient to have a benefits expert evaluate whether that was a fair claim and deprive the manager of knowing about that medical affair, which really isn't his responsibility?
Congressman Adams.
I think that what is lacking, essentially, is a national forum on the issue. We discuss it in Congress. We discuss it in the information industry and in the development of the computer industry and data industry. But basically, there isn't a popular national forum. Various proposals have been made to deal with that question. I think it's time to really deal with these questions because I think that the general public underestimates, as was very well pointed out in my colleague Barry Goldwater's remarks, the degree to which there is interference in the rights of privacy, both from governmental and non-governmental sources, without any meaningful protection. For example, I have some criticism of the development of all of the data systems and computer systems which are developed not only by government but by the private sector, because as they develop this important technology which we all recognize can advance society and civilization, they really don't build into the systems of protection, into these actual mechanical systems, any protection against invasion of privacy, which is a very important technological development. So that I think that a business and professional women's group, which I know and have worked with so closely on many issues and has such enormous impact in every community in which they work throughout the country, can begin to hold dialogues and forums on the issue. What are your rights? What is your right to know? And what does the government or private industry not have a right to know about you? And begin to popularize the issue.
Let's go to the gentleman in the right aisle.
George Peduta. I'm from Arlington, Virginia. The question is to the panel generally. Would you comment on what is apparently the growing use of polygraphs by private businesses to check on their employees?
I'd like to comment on that. I think that that is not sustainable in terms of the evidence that we've had so far before our committee on the validity of polygraphs and their scientific inaccuracy. As developed to date, it's been found that they are not sufficiently accurate so that they can't be used and are not used to take the ordinary lie detector or polygraph system as evidence in a court because they're not sufficiently reliable. And therefore, I believe that in most instances, and if not in all instances, I oppose the use of polygraphs. I think they're intimidative and harassing.
Dr. Brownson.
Well, I would just question whether, in fact, it's true. Certainly, our organization has never, to my knowledge, ever even thought about using a polygraph on anybody. And I think it's not something to be encouraged, but do you actually have data to suggest that this is growing?
I think I said apparently.
I have no comment because I wasn't aware that it was a growing practice. I don't know anyone in my congressional district that uses it.
All right, let's take a question from the gentleman in the left aisle.
Right. My name is Keith Snyder. I'm an editor of the Privacy Journal. If I could just follow up on this a minute, that practice of requiring polygraphing is growing indeed. We have statistics which we can give you later concerning that. My question is to be directed to Dr. Branscom. And as far as your principles, your four principles which you had commented, to ensure that those principles are not simply empty platitudes as far as IBM's advertising goes, are you wholeheartedly supporting H.R. 1984? And also insisting that the users of your computer systems comply with those principles?
Well, there's several questions there. Number one, with respect to insisting that our customers adhere to principles, we have no way to insist that our customers adhere to principles. We express our view on what the principles should be. We try to design systems that have in them the data security capability so that if the customer wants to provide restricted access of various sorts, he has the capability to do so, but it's up to that organization to make that decision, subject to law and the pressure of his customers, not the vendor. With respect to H.R. 1984, we don't have a company position on 1984. We certainly support the Privacy Act of 1974, which is law, and supported the principles that it embodied when it was under discussion.
As private sector.
As far as H.R. 1984, touches us as vendors because we provide equipment to the federal government in the same fashion that it would touch us as vendors if the law applied to the private sector. But with respect to 1984, I'll just make one comment. The Privacy Act of 1974 created a commission on which Congressman Goldwater sits, which isn't yet up to steam because it hasn't been fully appointed, and it should be. But that commission is precisely charged with studying the question of how these principles should apply to the private sector. And I think they ought to be allowed to do that job. With respect to 1984, I do have one little problem. I think that very clever label for the act has in it a kind of a hidden suggestion. It's just possible that some of the principles in 1984 might themselves be Big Brother rather than suppress Big Brother. For example, there's a proposal there of a federal board which would have the responsibility to know about any personal data file anywhere and would have certain types of access to information about it. Now, Alan Weston, in testimony before the Senate, noted a similar thing in Swedish law and raised the question of who would the president have appointed as charge of that federal privacy board. If it had been a few years ago, he suggested it might have been a man named Colson. I think we want to watch very carefully. A lot of people in this country are against gun control because they believe it's fundamental to the rights of citizens. I think the right of a small group of citizens to get together and organize a political movement or some other kind of movement and have their own files about their members and who they are and so on and not have the federal government know anything about it is probably pretty important to our liberties.
Well, the interesting question there, though, is in this manner now, in an uncontrolled fashion, is it not possible for those who are the most powerful in society with the largest amount of economic power to gain control?
I think that is facilitated precisely.
I mean, I don't exclude IBM as one of those people.
It's precisely to prevent those with access to authority having too much authority that I believe the rights of a citizen to organize their own information. There is a privacy associated with groups of people. And just want to be sure that when we try to make sure we restrict excesses of the exercise of authority by big, powerful organizations, we don't inadvertently subject the entire population to that same set of rules.
Look, I just want to make one thing very clear. When I deal with the question of the right of privacy, I'm talking about the individual rights and not the rights of IBM's privacy. There's a big difference. Now, we argued that question out in our committee before we developed the Privacy Act. We're talking about the individual rights guaranteed both specifically and philosophically by the nature of the structure of our government and our Constitution. We are not talking about the rights of privacy of IBM. As a matter of fact, we have very much, I think Mr. Goldwater is quite correct, we have very much a serious problem about making certain that our privacy rights are not only invaded by government, but by big business, which are the ones that develop these information systems and have not really properly taken care of the issue of the protection of privacy.
Bella, wait a minute. Bella, wouldn't you agree, though, that IBM really has the same right to privacy as the individual?
No.
IBM is an organization composed of people, thousands of people.
I know, but it's and a corporate
IBM
for profit
purposes. As a representative of those people, has the right, same right to that privacy as I or you.
Let me make a comment. Under the law, a corporation is a person, and in most legislative situations...
Yeah, but not under the Constitution. It's not an individual under the Constitution. You have to make that distinction. Yeah. It's a legal technicality that you're a person for legal purposes. Under the Constitution, we speak of private rights of individuals, not corporations.
Can Dr. Branscombe have the right to reply?
Absolutely.
I accept that view. My previous comment had nothing to do with defending the right to privacy of a large corporation. It had to do with just asking you to think a little bit about the implications of the civil rights of individual citizens who may want to organize, for example, a political organization, and who may not wish to be subject to a federal authority that demands that they reveal any data file, for example, membership list that they may have. Now, state laws can, of course, exempt political organizations from application of a disclosure law that is passed in the name of protecting privacy. But I just think we ought to be cautious. I agree with Congressman Goldwater. We ought to be cautious in being sure that the way in which we implement the legal requirements for the protection of privacy not itself constitute invasion of privacy.
All right, let's take a question now from the lady in the right aisle.
I'm Amy Goldstein from Silver Spring, Maryland. I'd like to ask Congressman Goldwater if Bill H.R. 1984 will protect us from private investigation firms such as Retail Credit Company, and if so, how?
The answer is, if enacted, yes. In the bill, one of the requirements is that that they collect the information directly from you instead of your neighbor. One. That two, that you know that this information is being collected about you. Three, you should have the right to examine that information. You should be able to have it deleted if it is not timely or pertinent or accurate. And if they won't delete it, you should have the right to file your own version of it or have access to the courts to have it deleted. So you will, in fact, under this law, if a credit agency is doing background information on you, information collection, you'll know about it and should know about it.
1984 to see it implemented.
Thank you very much.
I hope we don't either. I hope that credit agencies, as well as any business in the private sector, would get into the spirit of this law, as I mentioned, and start implementing. And I'm glad to see that there are some that are doing this. But we need it all across the country.
Let's go to the gentleman in the left aisle.
I'm Larry Gordon from Washington, D.C. Dr. Branscombe, I have a question for you concerning IBM's principles of privacy. In 1971, I believe it was, in May of 1971, a South African newspaper ran an article. It was entitled, "Computer Will Keep Tabs on Us All." This article went on to talk about an IBM computer that was being used in a population registration system in South Africa. This is part of a complementary system along with the African passbook system, which has quite a bit of notoriety worldwide. Talked quite a bit about 1984. In South Africa now, it is 1984, and it's 1984 of racism.
What is your question, sir?
My question is this. Is it not fair to say in the final analysis that the principle of profit comes out much more important to IBM and probably other major corporations than principles of privacy? And if you don't think that's a fair statement, can you justify IBM's business in South Africa?
I don't think it's a fair statement. We don't have any way, in fact, of balancing degrees of profit versus degrees of privacy. We provide the best product we know that we sell under circumstances that are determined by the policies of this government. We can exercise some degree of judgment and on our own with respect to what a customer is going to do. I assume that if we thought the mafia was going to use our one of our products for illegal purposes, we would try to drag our feet about selling it. But it is the policy of the United States government to have commercial relationships with South Africa. That particular computer you speak of is engaged in manipulating census data about the white population of South Africa exclusively, to best of my knowledge. I'm not thoroughly familiar with it.
I have a question that's been sent up by a gentleman who's come here from all the way from San Juan, Puerto Rico. His name is Juan Brasset. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And he asks the following. The CIA and other agencies have stressed national security reasons for surveillance. Have they elaborated to your satisfaction, and this apparently is addressed to anyone on the panel, have they elaborated to your satisfaction what they consider their guidelines for the future on the subject? And as a corollary to this, there's a second question up here addressed specifically to Ms. Abzug. Have you been able to get all the files from the CIA that you requested about yourself? Let's start with Congresswoman Abzug.
Well, that's true. The catch-all alibi that's used by the CIA for its covert and illegal activities, mind you, I'm talking of the domestic interference, which they have no right to do, is national security. Well, we've heard that before. I mean, it sounds very familiar. It's not any more convincing coming from Mr. Colby than it was coming from Mr. Nixon, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Mitchell. Now, the fact is that, well, this is a serious question, because although the American people are very proud of what they've done in turning back the efforts made at Watergate, we're still dealing with agencies of government that were sort of the instrumentalities to seize control, and that's why we're having these problems. This Congress of the United States has set up several investigative committees, select committees, to determine what the parameters are of the activities of the CIA, to make sure that they analyze what their needed activities are and separate that out from the activities that were illegal and that were just cover up and that were invasions of individual rights. As far as files are concerned, the reason I discussed my own files was to illustrate to the American people how far the invasion had gone. Yes, I got my file and a lot of related information, and Colby cleared me and said that I had done nothing wrong. And that doesn't, I don't know whether that's good or bad, but anyhow, I was cleared. I'm not so sure. But, and just today, you may notice that the Postmaster General of this great country of ours made a very specific regulation that in no way will the CIA be permitted to open the mail of individuals, which Americans regard as a fundamental right of privacy, because the CIA had been conducting activities in which they were opening up mail written to countries that obviously have different points of view than we do, but one has to write letters sometimes if one is a lawyer, for example, as I did. So that part of it has been done. There's also been a continuation of investigation in those areas by these committees, which I think will come up with the proper solution. Put the CIA in its place and put the American citizen and the agencies of government back into the Constitution so that we can be sure that in 1984 we'll have the glory of a great democracy instead of Big Brother Orwell controlling
us. All right. Let's go to the lady in the left aisle.
I'm Sylvia Ward, an ombudswoman of the Northwest area of Washington, D.C. My question is to Congresswoman Abzug. By law, must we disclose the Social Security number to the IRS to get a driver's license, to get credit, and to take a CLEP examination?
Take a what?
CLEP, you know, the university equalization exam.
Well, I mean, the question of the Social Security number, we've attempted to eliminate from government records through an amendment, by the way, that Mr. Goldwater pressed on our Privacy Act. Now, I think the question of the utilization of the Social Security number in various forms that are requested by agencies will become a matter that we're going to have to really see a greater enforcement about, because they do require it on many forms. And whether or not you can eliminate that information is highly questionable at this time. Now, I mean, Barry, what do you think on that?
Well, Bill, basically, what the amendment that we adopted said is that it would be unlawful for any federal, state, or local government agency to deny an individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law because of an individual's refusal to disclose his Social Security number. Right. Now, what this in essence did, this did not affect the usage of the Social Security number from the date of signature, January 1st, back. So in a way, it kind of freezes in today's practices, but it prohibits any further use without having the Congress mandating this. So I think we're going to have to analyze the use as it is today by the federal agency. It is by law that they're using it. President Roosevelt authorized the agencies of government to utilize Social Security number, and they've taken advantage of that.
The number from being used by IRS and various other agencies, if they already had.
Past practices are excluded, but anything from here on. Yeah.
But could I make a comment?
Yes, Dr. Brands.
I think attention still needs to focus on the real issue, which is the practice of interlinking one file for one authorized purpose with another. And as I understand the law, there's plenty of muscle in that law right now and in the legislative oversight committees of Congress to ensure that an agency responsible for giving a test for some educational benefits doesn't, in some insidious way, impact your Social Security benefits or some other benefits to which this is linked. That we can get at right now just by saying you shall not take those reels of tape from one place to another and search by Social Security number.
We have a young gentleman in the left aisle who has a question, I believe.
Mr. Goldwater, Mrs. Abzug, I'd like to know, am I, as a student, allowed to go in, say, to my principal's office and get my own IQ test scores?
I believe the law would say that you would not be able to until you reach the age of 18. But your parents can.
Who are you, young man?
I'm Tom Sturbutzel.
From where?
Clayton, Virginia.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Branscombe, what is IBM going to do with all the SRA scores that it has compiled over the years?
The SRA, the scores from Science Research Associates? I don't think IBM keeps test scores from individual students in our files. If we do, it's a surprise to me. We provide educational materials for schools to do so.
Every year, I mean every 2 years, to the students to...
We give the schools materials to administer tests, but we don't want to know what the scores of any of the students in the schools are.
Paper given back to me this year, giving me my score and all this, and it looked like it had IBM on the corners of it.
Right. It would, because the school was using an IBM, or this is an IBM subsidiary, Science Research Associates, using the materials that they provide, which have the, no doubt, a company label somewhere on it. But I assure you, we don't ask the schools to give us back that information and keep it in secret files. If they did, we'd send it right back.
Young man, you apparently are going to have a bright future. Have you considered going to the law? The gentleman on the right aisle.
Hello, my name's Ed Embier from Boston. I'm just questioning something to ask if this is an invasion of privacy for an individual. I'll have two cases. Let's say the first case, I'm purchasing a home from a realtor who's given me questionable information about a particular home. Is it possible for me as an individual to check, let's say, his court record? That would be an invasion of privacy for him or not? And the second one, let's say I am selling a car to someone who wants to purchase the car from me on time. Is it possible for me as an individual, again, to, let's say, check his credit? Would that be an invasion of privacy for him?
I think that you're checking his credit is one of the big issues that's come up. What kind of information has been gathered in this country about individuals for credit purposes has been one of the most serious invasions of privacy. And that's one of the things I believe that Mr. Goldwater hopes to address in his bill. On the question of court records, most of court records, except for those that are sealed, are public records open to anybody's inspection. And I think that where there is a privacy issue involved, there should be the right to have those records sealed from the public.
Seems to me there's a simple answer to the question on the credit. And that is, you say to the individual, look, if you want to buy the car on time instead of paying cash, that's a convenience for you. In order that I would agree to do that, would you agree to tell me what bank I should call in order to verify your credit? And if he says yes, call the so-and-so bank, it's okay with me, then you have his permission as part of the arrangement. And I don't see any great difficulty with that. That's different from sneaking off and hiring a private investigator to quiz his neighbors.
You know, I think Dr. Branscombe pretty well explained that, but that could be one of the requirements of selling the car, to see his credit. And if he does not want to give up that personal information, then obviously he won't be able to buy the car. But at least he has the information to make that decision. The quid pro quo, he gives up his personal information and he gets the car. That's what we're trying to do, is to give everyone all the information so they can make the decision. For instance, there was a local store here in Washington who recently sent my wife a little card that said and talked about their credit account. I was holding my breath, hoping that they were taking it away from her. But no. What it did was to spell out. All the things that they were going to do with that information. They were going to give it to credit companies, and they were going to use it for their own records, and they were going to use it for this and that. And if she agreed, then she'd sign the line at the bottom. And if she didn't agree, then she wouldn't get the credit account. But at least she's had all the information before her so that she could make an intelligent decision knowing what the quid pro quo was.
We have time for just one or two more questions. The lady in the left aisle has been patiently waiting.
I would like to know if the pregnancy tests now required by many companies are, in fact, now a violation of the right to privacy, and if H.R. 1984 will disallow the use of these.
I would say that fundamentally that kind of test violates the right of privacy. And that any tests that are suggested of that kind should be raised publicly and objected to, and I think as a matter of public policy, they have to be objected to.
What kind of test would you said pregnancy.
Acquired by potential women employees of many companies now.
Pregnancy is not contagious, and I don't think people ought to test for it.
That test goes beyond the question of invasion of privacy. It's a totally incorrect attitude towards women in our society who are entitled to the same equal opportunities for employment as our men, and I think that's just a continuation of that, and we hope to pass the Equal Rights Amendment before 1976 is over to take care of that.
Somehow I knew you'd get that in. Let's go to the final question, and I believe there's someone in the right aisle.
My name is Sheldon Simon. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. We're faced with a unique problem in Illinois in that we've had police spying on a local level interlinked with federal spying. My question is, how can this be controlled, considering that the police have an exemption under H.R. 1974.
These are local police.
Right.
And they wouldn't be covered by, even if they weren't exempted by this particular bill. You'd have to have state law for that. Although I think the Judiciary Committee is examining the whole area of criminal justice and how, what rights or what protections they should have. But under existing law today, you do not necessarily have that protection.
I'd like to indicate that there are several committees of Congress that are investigating this interlocking of information investigation of over 20 agencies that are dealing with intelligence information that they should not have and are also disseminating that information and utilizing local police to harass people based upon that. And I believe that as a result of all of the investigations of the Select Committee, my committee, the Judiciary Committee, that we will prevent, first of all, before it's all over, federal agencies from giving information to local police authorities who then seek to harass, intimidate, and interfere with the rights of individual citizens. And that whole question will be, as it's begun to be exposed, will be fully exposed so that we can be certain that we will eliminate that practice before it's all over.
For our final question from a lady who's been standing at the microphone very patiently for some time, let's go right down to the floor.
I'm Mrs. Socker from Bowie, Maryland, and I'd like to address this to Mr. Goldwater. There are questionnaires and forms constantly being forced on our children in the public schools. Will your commission do something to stop the invasion of privacy of the home in the schools?
Well, you know, I think that we as a Congress can do that. The mere enactment of this public law is not going to stop school systems from asking questions or prying into your family or to your home. That is probably as a result of health, education, welfare mandating or implementing laws which the Congress have passed. It may be in regard to income levels or race or education, but there are certain requirements by the Congress when we pass a law to give benefits to certain people, then in order to find out who these people are, we have to go out and, when I say we, I'm talking about HEW, has to go out and collect information to find out who is eligible. So I think that's where all this is coming from.
They need to know whether my husband likes me or I like my husband to go in those files. That helps them?
Well, I have no idea, but I whether that would qualify you or not.
Thank you. Our time, unfortunately, has run out. Our thanks to a very stimulating panel. Our guests have been Congresswoman Bella Abzug of New York, Dr. Louis Branscombe of IBM, Congressman Barry Goldwater, Jr. of California, and our thanks to you, the members of our audience here at Kennedy Center, and to those listening in on the member stations of National Public Radio.
Thus, the conclusion of this national town meeting, the subject was, how can the right of privacy be better protected? The moderator was Josh Darsa. I'm David Maupas. John Cater provided technical direction for this broadcast. Funds for this program were provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.